Session number 14219.
Colonel Meade, Reel 3.
I was taken to Stalag 4B, which is a place called Mühlberg, in between Leipzig and Dresden on the Elbe. And there we stayed. In actual fact, we were the last camp to be relieved. I know there were a lot of POWs who marched east and then they marched west and backwards and forwards, like the grand old Duke of York. In actual fact, we used to see them marching past the wire on route in one direction or the other. But we in 4B stayed there until the Russians released us, came in one night. The Germans, which either chased away or slaughtered. The Russians reoccupied the various posts, the gates, and the machine gun posts, and closed the gates. And there we stayed again with the Russians on the sentry go.
Did you see the killing of German guards by the Russians?
No, not actually. But there were the bodies laying around outside. Outside the wire.
Was it Russian infantry or tanks?
No, they were Cossacks. They seemed to be mounted on like little Shetland ponies, little shaggy horses, and big Russian swords and Kalashnikov weaponry. Quite an evil collection of characters.
What was their attitude towards the POWs?
Well, as I say, they just closed the gate, virtually the same as when the Germans were there, except they didn't give us any food. So we were slightly worse off at that stage. After about 5 days, we were told that we had to move to a town called Riesa, which was about 10 miles away. I think it's important to bear in mind when people say, "Well, why didn't you escape?" We were the wrong side of the Elbe to start with. We were the eastern side of the Elbe, and the Elbe there is, ooh, I don't know, 300, 400 yards across. So unless you actually had a boat or something, you had very, very little chance of swimming or getting across it. So unless you wanted to go east and go out via the Russian area, there wasn't a lot you could do at that stage in the game. Anyhow, we duly under escort, or I suppose as guard, were duly marched. So I forgot the interesting thing was there were quite a number of Russian prisoners in this camp. And the Russians were all duly released, given their weaponry, and pointed towards the Germans remaining and sent off into battle again. So the Russian POWs had departed. Anyhow, we duly went to Riesa, and we were told just to live where we could. So people lived in empty houses and so on. And there we stayed for about another 3 weeks. And this is the period where I believe that the negotiations were going over after the Chetniks and the Yugoslavs that the Russians wanted back, and the White Russians also wanted back. And the POWs, we were being held virtually as hostage for the exchange that was carrying on down in Austria and borders of Yugoslavia. Because during this period, the Americans came across in various means to negotiate with the Russians for our release, and there were all sorts of peculiar games played of there weren't enough vehicles to take us all in one lift, and no, it's too late in the day for us to be released. So the Americans were then sent back again, and this went on two or three, possibly more times, I don't know. But we would keep assembling in the market square, ready to go, and told to retire again. Eventually, they opened a bridge, and the Americans, God bless their cotton socks, sent dozens and dozens and dozens of lorries and lifted all the POWs in one bulk, took us to Halle, where the Americans had the airfield there, packed into Dakotas and flown to Brussels, landed at Brussels Bain. We were then taken to various reception camps and deloused and initial medical exchanges and given a bar of chocolate and spent the night there prior to being flown home to resettlement camps in this country.
Were you aware of the reasons why the Russians were procrastinating?
No, I don't think so. It's only since reading the various books and seeing the various programs on the television that it has due significance, really. We were the only POWs there, and in fact we were some months after other POWs. It was remember hearing VE Day being celebrated in Riza, when the Russians went round and fired every weapon in sight. And it was about another 3 weeks after VE Day before we. When was VE Day? In May the 20 something of that, wasn't it?
No, about May the 8th.
May the 8th. Yes, it was about the end of May we got home.
How did the Germans treat you in Mühlberg?
Well, we were there. Oh, the Germans. The German guards, well, they were. I think the writing was on the wall then. It was obvious that they weren't going to win. So I think they did the best they can. But it was. At that stage, we had no Red Cross parcels. Correction, I saw 1/8 of a Red Cross parcel in the 9 months I was POW. The Red Cross parcels were just not getting through. It was all very well, you know, the RAF bombing the railways and such like, but this sort of thing was not... Well, it was not helpful to the prisoners of war for mail. You know, I had no letters, we had nothing really. I didn't have a knife, fork, and spoon. I didn't have a toothbrush. I think I had one shower in about 8 months. You know, I was lousy from head to foot with every sort of vermin you could get. Really, this wasn't the Germans' fault at the stage in the game. Now, perhaps it's Germans' fault I shouldn't have been there, but it wasn't their fault that I was in such a poor state, really.
Why couldn't they give you water to bathe in?
I used to have water on for about a quarter of an hour a day. It used to be turned on, and if you rush in and you time you're drunk and sluiced out the one loo we had in the room, and... There was nothing left for, and one or two may have got in a shower, but it was very, very difficult. No, I had no razor blade. I had no razor. And we had virtually nothing at all.
But why could they only turn the water on for a quarter of an hour?
Well, the shortage of water, I think the pipes were burst, shortage of water, and... everything really was in a terrible state, and it's always an interesting discussion, debate, when you talk to chaps who were taken prisoner at Dunkirk and us who were taken prisoner at Arnhem or possibly later, difference between four and a half years and possibly 7 or 8 months. And the main thing was that the chaps who'd been in a long time were completely set up. They had food by the stack, they had cigarettes by the stack, the Red Cross parcels through, it was obvious they'd saved food. There'd been parcels from home, people, your relatives were allowed to send you cigarettes and certain clothing. So I'm not saying I'd like to have been there for 4 or 5 years, but these films you see with the normally officers in Oaflegs, you know, with their jolly little silk cravats wandering around, didn't bear a lot of resemblance to what it was like in a lot of camps with about 6 or 9 inches of mud, the sewers overflowing, and you know, virtually just a bowl of soup a day and a tenth of a loaf of bread.
What kind of impression did the Red Army make on you as soldiers?
Well, they were, individually, they were quite good. When we were on the loose in Riza, we went out on, I suppose it would be commonly called looting, getting food, you know, raiding farms and this sort of thing, German farms. And if a Russian were coming along, you know, you were frantically trying to chase a chicken, he would, up with his Koneshkin off, and lose off about 50 rounds at the chicken, and then, you know, laugh with glee when you picked up a couple of feathers. And you know, he was trying to be helpful, I suppose, trying to shoot the chicken for you. But they, again, nothing at all, but you know, the conditions they lived in, the initial assault troops, the Russian assault troops, were not given anything. There was no supply column supporting their frontline troops, their assault troops. They lived on the land. They were told, well, there's a village ahead, there's plenty of food there. If you want food, wine, women and song, or if you go and capture it. So they go and capture it and take the wine, women and song and whatever they could store, and this is how they went. Well, this is why they were so successful, though they didn't have the supply columns that had to keep the American and British armies going. There were the long communications from Cherbourg up to Brussels. It was they were just pointed in the right direction, wound up and off they went. And I'm not saying the follow-up troops are totally, but the initial assault troops, this is how they operated.
Were you able to speak to them and have any conversation?
Well, you made signs and such like, and they'd hand you a bottle of wine or something like that, and you all have great laughs and ha 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 and sort of thing. And but it was reasonably fragile. You know, it was obvious things weren't going well, that we were being kept there. It was obviously excuses were being made for why we couldn't be released. So it was a bit brittle at times.
How were the Germans treated by the Red Army?
Oh, well, they were generally raped, looted and shot, you know, whichever. And so we used to finish up with three or four Germans wandering around behind you, please come and stay with us and all this sort of thing. Which again was a bit difficult and a bit dangerous to get involved in that sort of line.
Did you ever protect Germans?
No. I think this would have been more than it was worth, really.
In what way?
Well, I think the Russian would have just shot you as well then, so it was...
Did you see any ill treatment of Germans?
No.
We hear quite a lot about nowadays about the need for counselling of people who've been in wars. Mm. What do you think of that?
Pretty good profession. I think I might see if I can get a job for it.
Did you feel in need of counselling at the end of the war?
No more than my father did in the First World War, and after 4 years in the trenches, it's. I don't know. I don't understand it. I think the generation gap comes in here somewhere, would you?
Did you find it difficult to readjust to civilian life after the war?
No. In fact, it's quite interesting. From the resettlement camp in UK, I was just given a railway warrant, and so I was in a leave pass for a fortnight. So I got on the train and got home and caught a bus to my house in Southampton. Walked up and knocked on the door and said, "Hello, Mum, I'm home," sort of thing. And
Did you ever have nightmares about war?
no, not really.
Or hear of anybody who did?
No, I don't think so. No, I don't think so.
Can we go on to the Malayan emergency now? Because you were there from 55 to 57 with the Army Air Corps. Can you
Well,
tell
no,
me?
the glider pilot regiment at that stage still. The Army Air Corps wasn't formed till mid 57. September 57, I think I'm right in saying.
Can you tell me about the work you were doing in Malaya, please? In the Malayan emergency?
Yes, the background briefly, there was a squadron, there was an AOP squadron in Malaya 656 squadron that had served in the Far East right the way through the Malayan War. They'd been in Java, and then when the emergency broke out in Malaya in 48, they were based with various flights around the countryside in Malaya. They were operating Oster aircraft, I think majority Oster 6s, possibly a few 5s. As the work developed and the realization that the work they were doing was essential, there was the demand for more pilots. So there were somewhere about 30 odd glider pilots total left at this stage in the game. They were converted onto Austers and sent to Malaya, Korea, and Germany. I was in Germany in that time flying Austers and went to Malaya and joined a 1914 flight that was an AOP flight. I was still an NCO at that stage. Flying Austers out of a place called Seremban in Negri Sembilan. Now the work was mainly reconnaissance in that each pilot in the flight had an area, and we used to reckon on flying the area. This is jungle, rubber, lalang, the whole area. Sorry, I should say the 1914 flight, the flight was I was in, had this broad slice straight across Malaya from the west coast to the east coast, and covered a large amount of jungle. And as I said earlier, we used to fly our particular area, each pilot's area, about once a week. And after a period of time, you could start to pick up changes. You could start to pick up bare ground under trees. You could start to pick up paths that have been, and if you're very lucky, you could start to pick up the communist camps under if you got the light right and looking at the right height and the right time of the day and so on. You could see parade grounds and bashes. So by flying once a week at the area, you could see over about 9 months, you got to know an area down well. You knew when a tree went down, there was something different there. Also, we supported various units. I supported the 2nd 6th Gurkhas for about 2 years. In that, I flew for them. I used to resupply, although the main resupply was done by the RAF, such items as their Gurkha rum used to be, they didn't used to trust the RAF to fly that in case they broke the bottle, so we used to go and drop it out, suitably parachuted down into their area. We used to do fixes for them when they based up for the night. They used to put up a balloon, which break through the canopy, and we'd be flying about 3,000 or 4,000 foot well back. You could see the balloon come through and work out their position, pass their position back on the net, and so they'd have a position then. We could do airstrikes. At that stage in on Singapore Island was number one Royal Australian Air Force operating Lincoln bombers. And if we were fortunate enough to get a camp, we could, if necessary, if the higher ups decide, carry out a target mark, which consisted the stage I was there of using flares, parachute flares, which we'd drop onto the camp, and then the bombers would bomb from about 10,000 foot onto the flare, somewhere about 40 seconds after you put the flare down, so it didn't give them time to get away. Leaflets, we used to go off with 50, 60,000 leaflets, scatter them all over the jungle area, like, you know, surrender, oh, Tim Lu is packed up and he's here and so on, or someone else is sleeping with your wife, etc., your girlfriend, your mother's died, all these sort of leaflets we used to push out, addressed by name in the majority of cases to individual people who we knew in the jungle itself. The main person of interest in our area was a chap called Tien Fu Long, who actually was called 10 Foot Long. He was one of the SOE supplied and trained during the war to operating against the Japanese. In fact, he was awarded the British Empire Medal and took part in the victory parade in London, I believe. I'm not certain, I believe he was there. He was the boss man of 3rd Independent Platoon, which was a party of about 35, 40 strong, who operated in our state. So we knew quite a lot about him. We knew when he came down into the villages to see his girlfriend. Mind you, it was normally 12 hours late then, but we knew he'd been down. And we spent quite a long time chasing him around. At least we thought we did. Eventually, he was killed in a strike. They had various devices that were in the jungle.
In an airstrike, you mean?
Yeah. There were various devices that were used at this stage to give us the position, and his camp was duly marked, and he was killed in a strike.
I don't suppose you remember an operation called Kingly Pile, because I once tape recorded South Wales border officer who described
not
a strike on the jungle.
Not a big chap, is he? Big man, about 6 foot two, three, four.
No.
I was thinking the CO, we flew a lot. No, I don't. No. It was very, very much of, we had our own sector. We knew our own sector backwards. We knew everyone who breathed and lived in that area. And, you know, the areas north and south, we didn't get too involved in, unless it was necessary to, in order for the communists to be unaware what was going on. For instance, they knew very well these strips we were operating from. And there's no doubt about it with the country out there that some of the strips, certainly our strip at Seremban, was observed. So if it was necessary, we would get pilots in from one of the bordering flights to take off in their area and come down and operate in our area. So, no, we didn't really know a lot of what went on the other side, if it was in another flight's area.
Was there any ground fire danger for you?
No, not a lot, because they were well aware that we had the ability to bring down gunfire onto anyone who fired on us. There were Royal Artillery mounted around the area in various sites. And although I suppose it's a fair bluff as well, we did used to do a certain number of controlled shoots into, mainly from a harassing point of view, if we wanted to try and get particular people to move out of an area into a more suitable area, we could bring down gunfire onto an area. Not that I suppose it did much good, but at least it shifted them along. Or occasionally we'd have the Royal Navy off coast. We had HMS Newfoundland kind of cruised up and down off coast for about a month. And we used to use her with her big guns firing in. We could control their gunfire and firing onto camps or suspect areas inland.
And you said these were Auster aircraft?
Austers, yes, yes.
How suitable were they for the job?
They were very, very good for what was required. But same as everything military, you try to pack a little bit more in to do just a little bit more thing and bring another radio in or have another piece of equipment on board. So they were adequate. A lot of the strips, we used to go into the jungle forts, and virtually right the way down the spine of Malaya were established forts. Mainly for the protection of the Aborigines, but also to restrict usage of the area to the CTs. I suppose the old idea of building a string of forts down and patrolling in between, they could restrict them. But we used to have to go into them occasionally, either to bring someone out or take someone in, passenger, and a lot of them were very, very marginal, very, 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 very tight little clearing strips.